This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Sci-Fi and Scream Undead, a podcast of Joy 94.9 with Sonya the Squeamer and Clay Talks.
Welcome to our very first Sci-Fi and Scream Undead.
Undead again.
So, the show is taking a bit of a rest from live on air. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of dead, yep. But we're not quite dead. So we're undead.
I'm not quite alive.
We're not quite alive.
Some of us
we're
don't
not quite
feel very alive. Anyway,
you're yeah. looking very alive, Sonia.
Yeah, look, Melbourne International Film Festival. That's what we're tackling. Sports reference, but that's what we're okay. That's what we're stabbing into. That's a better reference.
That's good.
Stabbing and garrotting and screwing and strangling. Putting it in its place and checking out all the genre film on the night shift. The night shift is sort of like, I don't know. It's the hub of all the horror films and psychological thrillers they have showing at this year's 2016 festival. And we've got things like we're going to be talking about Under the Shadow, The Devil's Candy.
I Am Not a Serial Killer, as you try to convince people.
Yeah. Yeah. Belief, The Possession of Janet Moses, and just a little wee one, an Aussie one called Killing Ground.
Not that we won't be watching too many movies or anything.
I know. I'm not sick of it yet, but it is a little bit tiring. Let's face it.
It's a lot of work. Watching films is a lot of work.
Watching films to talk about films, yeah, that's where the work. It's not like you're lying back with a nice drink of some sort, relaxing. You can't really relax. And these films aren't really relaxing films anyway.
No, they're not.
The genre.
The Melbourne International Film Festival has its night shift. Is that what it's called?
Night shift, yep.
So that's where they focus on horror genre? Yep. And why do you think they do that?
Because it's part of the festival, I think, and they've also got a director of the film festival, who Michelle Carey, and she's wonderful, and she's a big horror fiend or fan, loves her giallo, of course, mixing it up there, and I think it really is helpful because you know that most of the horror, not all, but most of the horror will be in a one place that you can find it. Now, that's not necessarily the case for all of them because there are some that probably come under horror that you'll find in other parts of the festival. That's okay. At least maybe there's 10, 12 films that are specifically considered horrific in Night Shift. And it's always been a fun part. And it's great to see it grow. It's really gone from, I think they had, the first time they did it, they only had four or five films. Mm. But now they've got like a dozen. So it's just
fabulous.
Increasing because the popularity is there, I believe. So.
Yeah, so Under the Shadow, which is going to be our first film for this evening.
Yeah. It's the little film that's doing so well. It's certainly getting a lot of attention and festivals all over the place. It started its first run at the Sundance Film Festival, January of 2016. It's written and directed by Babak Anvari. He is an Iranian, Iranian-born, I believe, and part of the diaspora of many Iranian creatives. It's out through Wigwam Films, Mina Films, Doha Film Institute, Creativity Capital, and it's a UK, Jordan, Qatar production. Actually filmed in Jordan, I found out.
Oh, okay. Well,
to get the authenticity without having to worry about going to Iran, where it would probably be under great suspicion if they did film it there.
Absolutely.
Probably. There are many restrictions that they have in Iran about certain things for political reasons.
Okay.
So what's the film about?
So a mother and daughter are living under the Tehran, I believe it's called, which is the political regime, I believe, at the time. Or is that the name of the city?
That's the name of the city.
The name of the city. Tehran. So in Tehran...
The Khomeini regime,
yeah,
I believe.
So they're living without male figure in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just existing in this world, but then something more sinister starts to creep into their world. More's probably the wrong word.
Something wicked this way comes.
Yes.
Literally,
nice
flies.
Reference.
Because
absolutely.
There's references throughout the film about the wind.
Yes.
Watch out for the wind. There's lots of cultural references to something called the djinn. Or djinn.
Djinn, just djinn.
Spelt in English anyway with a D. Also known to us, I suppose, as the genie. And this is a malevolent force, not a nice I dream of genie force.
No.
These are nasty wind-like characters, you know, and so on. So,
well, this is the story that became the genie. In a lot of mythos and stuff, these are they're still the Wishmasters. Mm. And there's actually a series of movies called Wishmaster, which are also very much about the djinn. And in my youth, I very much enjoyed those films.
So if you've seen Arabian Nights, any sort of more close to the original content of the story, and these are thousands and thousands of years old, these stories. It's a bit like the Grimm's Brothers for the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get an idea of the malevolent and nasty types of apparitions and crafty and scheming characters that these djinn are.
Yeah, not a lot of wish genie. Happening. Wishes happening.
No,
other than,
it's
other
not
than a, I wish you'd go away.
Yeah. There's no rubbing of the bottle here.
No. Oh. No, the husband's away.
Yeah, so he's away because he's, poor thing, he's been drafted because of this political regime. They're at war with Iraq, and that was one of the longest wars in the world. That was a conventional war. That still holds that record.
Mm.
It's an unfortunate record to hold because it was a disaster for both sides and all the people trapped in the middle. So he's been drafted. He's a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to be a doctor. And when I say she, I am talking about, of course, the fabulous lead actress in
Nargis,
this.
Nargis Rashida.
Nargis.
Sorry.
Yep. Let's do that again. Nargis Rashidi. And she plays Shida, the mother, wife, the woman that wants to be a doctor. She's been basically expelled or not allowed back into the university in Tehran because we get an allusion that, well, alludes to that she was involved in left-wing politics.
Mm.
So they're now being ousted, and she's almost the first scene is her begging to come back to the university. It's really uncomfortable as a woman watching another woman have to do that when you know the reason for it. She has to cover up as well because it is now a Muslim culture,
mm-hmm.
Condition. And that, of course, comes up throughout the film.
Absolutely.
That's quite an
important part of the film is that she has to hide herself throughout the film.
Yeah, well, she's supposed to.
It's supposed to.
But
in its own way, it's because of the absence of men throughout this film, it's quite feminist in its own way.
Yeah. Or there are men in it. They're usually a sort of second or third rate type of authority figure.
Yeah, the characters that women often play.
It's interesting. Mm. So, yeah, the background is the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, which went from 1980 to 1988. We've had the Iranian Revolution from 1979. A woman's place has certainly changed dramatically because we're talking about a very highly educated gender.
Mm.
I have to add here that some of the most intelligent women I've ever come across, intelligent people, literally, smartest people are Iranian people.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible education system at the time. And there's a little girl, Dorsa, played by Arvind Manshadi. Now, we will have some of the interview with Babak Anvari. And I'll just add here that I haven't spoken to you about this yet, Clayton, because I haven't seen you.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Until that. But Arvind Manshadi is a refugee child. She does not have a passport.
Oh, wow.
When they were to film in Jordan, she did not have permission to enter the country. So they had to go through some string pulling to allow her to have permission. She basically, as a displaced person, you do not have a passport.
Mm.
She's allowed to travel through Europe, providing her paperwork is up to date. But this little girl has no home.
Oh, wow.
She is a little authentic little Iranian girl, and she is a refugee. And yeah, it was quite moving for him to talk about that.
And she does a wonderful job throughout the film in the character.
Amazing.
Absolutely, incredible.
Scary too. She's quite, we won't spoil it, but quite a scary little darling.
Look, all children are scary.
Flick that switch.
Yep, that's it.
Too much sugar, mm-hmm. something can happen.
Yeah.
And also, I think the other star of the show, or the film, which I don't see her here on the credits.
Oh.
Kimia. The doll.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, yes, that's cute. And cute. Evil.
But we digress.
She's the Iranian version of the doll from The Conjuring.
Annabelle,
thank you.
All right, so what do you think of this film?
I thought it was a solid performance all around, from the directing, the acting, the cinematography was really interesting. Mm. It wasn't like the most amazing that I've seen, but it's just interesting.
Yeah.
And I just think the film is absolutely worth seeing, and I hope it gets a wider release, which horror films, it's often hard to get those wider releases, but it's definitely worth going and checking out if you can. It is on at MIFF. Mm. Has two screenings, I believe. One is actually Friday night on the 29th, mm-hmm. which hopefully we'll get this up before then so people can actually go see it.
The other one's on the 30th. I think it's 11:30. No, you can't touch that.
No, I can't touch that.
You can't touch that. You want to touch that.
I know. I need a computer. I'm going to give it a solid 8 out of 10.
Yeah. It's actually XYZ Films. I forgot to mention that.
Oh, cool.
Spoke to the producer, Oliver Ruskell. So he's over here. They're here at the moment to promote the film. So, yes, I'm giving it 8 out of 10. What did you give it?
8 out of 10.
Oh, look at that.
We agreed.
Yeah, I know. And, of course, it does have a nice little cameo of somebody that we do know from previous... one previous Iranian horror film, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
Ah, yes.
It has got the beautiful Arash Marandi as Dr. Reza.
Nice.
And he is in, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. So, fabulous film. And, of course, as soon as I mentioned that to Babak Anvari, he's like, yeah, we all know each other. Because the fascinating thing about this film is every single one of the Iranian actors in here, they're all people that do not live in Iran because they cannot live in Iran.
And make
time.
These films.
Mm. Their opportunities aren't there. Their parents left. They were small children or born there, and then their parents had to go to Germany. A lot of them moved to the UK, America, United States, of course, Canada, and Sweden and places like that. And so he had to round up all these actors and try to get them to Jordan to do the film in such a limited time with little money. Amazing experience, I'm sure, and I'm sure that itself would bond. And you feel that in the film, that people are doing this because this is a passion project. This
absolutely.
Is definitely something that you feel it in the film.
Well, when you're making a film that's not going to be released in the audience that it's targeted at, essentially, you're not making it for money.
Exactly. No, because this was a surprise to me, this one. Yeah, I can't stop raving about it, but I'm going to have to stop talking about it.
We have to move on. We've got so much to talk about.
I know.
You're listening to our very first Sci-Fi Unsqueam Undead.
Hi, I'm Babak Anvari, writer, director of Under the Shadow.
Hi, I'm Oliver Roscoe, one of the producers of Under the Shadow.
And Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy
94.9.
Is it 94.9?
94.9.
Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Oh, beautiful. Bravo. Great. Thank you
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Cheers. Cheers. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Sci-Fi and Scream Undead.
For our second film this evening on Sci-Fi and Scream Undead, we're looking at another little MIFF gem. Well, gem, maybe, maybe not.
A bloody diamond.
Blood diamond. Oh, no, let's go into that, actually. No. I Am Not a Serial Killer, which is based on the books by Dan Wells, a series of three books, and then I think there's another three which are kind of separate but adjacent books as well. The first book has the same title, I Am Not a Serial Killer.
Mm. And it's the John Cleaver trilogy, I believe.
Yes, John Wayne Cleaver. So there's that John Wayne Gacy little reference there, yes. John Wayne Cleaver.
Mm.
Yeah, so his series of books has been made into a film, and it's kind of aimed at the teen market, but it's definitely pushing that boundary of what is teen and what is adult, I think.
I think so. Yes. So, look, I've got to get round to finishing watching the film, of course, but I'm impressed. It's it's a very strange hybrid as well.
Because
it's got some people that some of our listeners might be aware of. And also it's funded through the Irish Film Board, fantastic film, Floodland Pictures, Quickfire Films, The Fizz Facility, Waterland Pictures, and T-Short, and Film Company Production. But it's also got some character actors who are not American, but it's set in the heartland of America, although I believe it was North Dakota, which isn't considered the heartland in the books.
But it's,
that's where it's set. But in the film, it's a different setting.
Again. It is. And it, look, the setting works very nicely as being...
You think? I mean, I haven't read the books.
I haven't read the books either. So in the film, I think the setting works quite nicely with the whole blankness that's sort of happening in this rural, almost semi-rural setting.
It's kind of like a Twin Peaks, David Lynch.
Yeah, there's definitely that sort of feel.
Because there's that idiosyncrasy and eccentricism.
Mm.
That seems to come through. And even from the beginning, when you see the titles come up, I Am Not a Serial Killer, it has that very retro red on the screen superimposed over the images, and it's got that All Rights Reserved TM or something underneath it, just like those films from the, like a pulp film. A cult film, B-grade film from the 70s.
Absolutely.
So there's obviously, this is a little pastiche. Well, it seems to give clues that it is, but it isn't.
I think it's well, not. It's not really, yeah. It's anyway, the main character, John Wayne Cleaver. I'm about to say Gacy.
Yes. Yeah, I think John Wayne Cleaver.
I think, yeah, this is not really subtle.
Too obvious.
So he is a sociopath. And he is pretty much devoid of understanding human emotion, and apart from anger. He's a teenager, yeah. But no, he is actually a diagnosed sociopath, and he's pretty much made up a set of rules for his life to make sure that he doesn't kill people.
Yeah, and which is probably common sense.
Yeah, it's great. And look, he's clearly pretty good at following them because he hasn't killed anyone yet. He suddenly realizes that there's another serial killer in town.
Or a real one.
A real one, not him. So one who's actually killed people. And he slowly gets the impression that serial killer is closer to him than he expected.
Ooh.
And that it may not be quite as simple as, well, simple as a serial killer can be, as it seems.
It's not your Jeffrey Dahmer sort of thing. It's not completely Alfred Hitchcock style as well. And but I love the opening sequences as well. I love the parts where he works, obviously, after school job as... It's a funeral.
Yeah, his family owns a funeral home.
Yeah.
And his after school job is going to help with the bodies. Which, if you've got a sociopath, I'd probably think I'd want to remove them to a non.
But there's not much work. It's a tiny, tiny community. It's true. Clayton. It's called Clayton.
Oh my God, the town is called
Clayton. That's right. Yeah.
And did I not have issues?
I'm not a serial killer.
There's a few things here.
There is a few things. You're noticing a pattern?
Yeah. I was going through the whole thing going, I just stop saying my name.
I love the opening part. I love some of the parts that were there in the Undertaker funeral home. And they're in the, what's it called? Well, where the bodies come in and do whatever they do.
The morgue?
It's very, it's not really a morgue.
No, it's the
Undertakers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they do?
No, they are Undertakers, yeah.
So the bodies do arrive. Obviously from the coroner. The bodies are taken there and put on the slab, basically. And it's just fantastic because you see the organs have been removed. And they put the organs into a nice red plastic bag. I guess, I don't know why it's red, but it's great that they have removed the organs. It makes it easier for the embalming to happen.
Absolutely.
And you've got that lovely way of... separating and categorizing things, which I love. I enjoyed that. And I love the embalming fluid. It was bright pink.
It was a gorgeous
color.
And
they pump it in. They show you how they do it.
Mm. There's certainly no subtlety in that.
No, there's no subtlety. They cut away and pour it in or pump it in. And then, of course, the blood pumps out. And after a body's been dead for some time, obviously from lack of mobility and so on, the blood is incredibly difficult to remove from a body. I don't know if anyone's tried this. It is hard work. It is hard work. You really do need...
I'm a little nervous about being in the studio you at the moment.
Well, you really do need the equipment for it.
Yeah.
Vacuum cleaners don't work. They really don't.
If anyone would like to call the police, we're at Joy in Burke Street.
But they don't. It's like trial and error. Anyway, I digress. But I did feel... a great comfort in that, actually.
Mm. The other thing about the funeral home is that's how he gets connected to the serial killer in finding that these
bodies are turning up. Yeah.
And there's pieces missing from the bodies.
I know. Or an arm. There's an arm missing. Yeah. Bits and pieces, we want to know why, don't we?
And, yeah. And it's never more than one at a time. So there's one thing missing from this one thing missing from this one. So it's not someone just taking them all.
It's a bit like a smorgasbord, I think.
It's a very slow one.
Very slow one. Also, I did notice that there's a Scottish actress in there for some of our listeners who are of the sapphic variety. We'll notice her, Laura Fraser. She was Kat McKenzie in the lesbian TV drama Lip Service, made in Scotland. And that wasn't even a very good Scottish accent.
No. But still, thank you for that. That's
good. Thank you. She's pretty cool.
And I'm pretty sure that almost everybody who watched this film recognised Christopher Lloyd.
He looks old.
Yeah, does look old. But
it's funny, isn't it? He looks his age, I suppose.
Yes, probably. But he is also very creepy.
Very, very creepy.
As the neighbour Crowley. Crowley?
Obvious. Alistair.
Crowley, yes.
Alistair. Mm-hmm. Mr. and Mrs. Crowley, you know. Yeah.
Which is one thing about this film. There's no subtlety whatsoever. It hits you with the sledgehammer.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if it's like the book, though. It kind of feels like a student film in many ways, or a first-timer filmmaker, where it can be quite clumsy with all these obvious references. But at the same time, what I did engage with was the sound, the sensibility. The soundtrack is marvellous. I presume there are probably local bands that have been used in there, a few, and also enjoyed the cinematography of it.
Sure, absolutely.
Lots of neon and...
And they're really
shot in the dark, a lot of it shot in the dark.
Mm. Unpolished feel to the whole film.
Unpolished which turd.
I'm definitely not saying that. No, but I think that works really well for it, though.
But yeah, look, it's not subtle at all. but look, so far I've enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even you haven't quite seen any the turkey stuffing episodes and.
So up to the point that you've seen, what would you give it out of 10?
I'd give it a 7. No, actually, no, that's too. I give it a 6.
6?
So far, yeah.
I probably go 7, I reckon. I'm pretty cool with a 7 because it had a lot of things that appealed to me.
Yeah, and it has Christopher Lloyd.
Absolutely.
And Max Records.
Max Records, by the way, we haven't mentioned. And he did an amazing job of playing John Wayne Cleaver. Meet the Cleavers. And so he's great. I really loved him.
With a cleaver. Yeah. I love that scene. He gets the... His father is obviously estranged from them, and the mother's bringing up. So he's surrounded by a lot of women, obviously. It's his aunt that lives there, or is it his, I don't know who she is.
His aunt who his aunt I think runs the funeral home, and then mum's quite heavily involved in the funeral home as well.
And the daughter as well, his sister. So I'm up to that part where they have Christmas, and he gets an MP3 player from his dad, and his dad's written a note saying, "It's just like having dad in your pocket." It's a funny line. But
it's very uncomfortable scene.
Very. Mm. So, yes, failure in parents, absent fathers. That seems to be the theme for at least the two films so far.
Absolutely.
Is that what makes a horror film? No dad women. In the picture. Shut up, you.
No, I know.
What makes a good horror film.
Absolutely. But it's great that these films are definitely, even though in this one the main character's not a female, there's still that really strong female presence to it. So.
Okay, so who's the director?
The director is Billy O'Brien.
Cool.
Which it definitely fits him with the Irish theme.
Really. He might be Irish. I know that Monster Pictures have bought this. So this is one of their babies.
I think this is a good possibility because of the book connection of getting a wider release. I don't know how big the book is in Australia because I've never heard of it till I watched this. So hopefully that somebody will pick it up for a wider release. That is Billy O'Brien's I'm Not a Serial Killer. It is on at MIFF as well. If you search I'm Not a Serial Killer in the MIFF website, you will certainly find it with all the dates.
This is nowhere. It isn't supposed to happen here. It's supposed to be somewhere else. It all just feels so close.
Well, we're missing a kidney.
What if the person who killed him took it?
Thank you. Sci-Fi and Screaming
Undead.
You're listening to our very first Sci-Fi and Scream Undead, which I'm going to stop saying like that eventually. And we are talking MIFF films tonight. MIFF is obviously starting tonight, I believe, from our point of view, because we're recording this. But
yeah, it runs till, wow, it's 20th of July to 14th of August. Loads of fun.
Absolutely worth your time. And if you don't get to see these films we're talking about, we'll let you know whether they're worth sourcing or not.
Here we go. Night Shift. So Under the Shadow, yes, Friday the 29th. July, 9 p.m, Saturday the 30th, 11:30 p.m. That's what we've spoken about so far. I'm Not a Serial Killer, Friday the 29th, 11:30 p.m. And Friday the 12th of August at 9 p.m. There we are.
Our next film we're going to do is one that I haven't seen. Sonia the Screamer.
Uh-huh.
And I'm Clayton Claytox, by the way, since I don't think we're actually
Claytox
introduced
like
ourselves.
Pox.
Yes. So in case you're actually wondering, and you've got this far and going, who the bloody hell are these people?
Turn off yet.
No, it's keep listening. We're a bit mad-capped, but we have fun. Over the desk from me, we have Sonia the Screamer. Do you want to use your last name? Are we Sonia Hammer? We have Sonia Hammer.
Who, I wish it was Axe.
Or a Cleaver.
Actually, you've seen what, you know, a hammer is for nails.
Hammers for nail, axes for axe. Okay, I'm writing this down.
Because the effect a hammer has on a person's skull, for example, it's like, it isn't like eggshell. It's just a bit. Anyway,
it creates a subdural hematoma, which, now I'm the bloody serial killer. Okay, and I am Clayton.
The floaty bits.
I am Clayton Claytox Wimshurst on the box. I'm not going to be in the box from now on. Well, no. I'm going to be everywhere.
Yeah.
And I am not taking over, but I'm trying to helm a little more. I'm in charge of this. I'm not doing a great job, to be honest. I can't keep you in control, can I? No, I am going to be working with Sonia, who is our fabulous sci-fi and scream expert. But I'm going to be putting a lot more of this stuff together just because Sonia is busy with another show called Broad, which you can find on Monday nights at 9 p.m.
I know.
On Joy 94.9.
It's pretty different. It's nothing to do with axes or...
No, there's Hammers. Depends on the episode. But, Sonia, you got along to see a film that I haven't seen, and it isn't called...
Killing Ground by Damien Power. And another feature film debut. It's an Aussie one this time. Australians are represented this year in Night Shift, and that doesn't happen all the time, but it's pretty cool. So we've got Killing Ground, which is Australian, as I mentioned. We've also got The Devil's Candy, which we'll talk about a bit later, and that's from Sean Byrne. But this is Damien Power, and it stars Aaron Peterson, the gorgeous and wonderful Indigenous actor, and Aaron Glenane, who I don't know much about, but they're both called Aaron, and they're both pretty obnoxious and horrible people, as it turns out. Killing Ground is basically, if you've seen, those sorts of films, what do they call them? Not in Home Invasion, but they're sort of like Country Invasion, when people from the city slickers, go to the country. And, of course, the people in the country are mad. You know, or like serial killers or murderers or just crazy.
Boy from the country over the desk from your life, by the way.
Sorry. But you know what I mean. A bit like, oh, God, if only I could use the internet right now. But I'm trying to think. What's the name of that one with the banjo on the porch?
Deliverance?
Yes. Yes. Think of Deliverance. And let it follow. Just let it flow.
Ba-da-ding, ding, 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 ding.
Could probably put it in there, actually. Think of that. Instead of banjos, think of Swiss Army Knives. There is a dog called Banjo in this film, believe it or not. Think of Camping Sites. A baby's crawling in the dirt. Abandoned babies in the dirt.
We might be on to Evil Angels at this point.
It was a dingo. Yeah. It was Meryl Streep that took my baby. Think of a timeline that flashes back and forward. A little bit confusing at first, but a very interesting idea and works quite well for a while.
I'm a really big fan of the non-linear storytelling, so the storylines go back and forth. It works very well.
It's a bit like my life. It's like, and so it does have a very strong sense of dread. And ominous. And again, it's a bit schlock. It's a bit like those nature exploitation films that Australia used to bring out in the past, in the 70s. It's like Long Weekend, those sorts of things. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to check out someone like Lee Gambin. This notorious and yet strangely wonderful man has put together a book about that very thing, Ozploitation, actually. It sort of harks to that, and I suspect that Damien, the director, probably is a fan of those sorts of films. So it's very low budget. Like I said, first-time feature. Has this forward and back timeline where you're not sure what's going on. Basically, a couple go to this little lakeside in the middle of, you know, wonderful Australian outback. And it's a recommendation by a local, which is played by Aaron Peterson. And not a very, well, he seems like a nice enough, friendly enough bloke. But of course, as we find out later, he's not very nice or friendly at all. They seem to have a bit of an obsession with guns and setting dogs onto people. But I digress. The couple, of course, he's going to pop the question by the lakeside. It's very romantic until they notice the orange tent. An orange tent near their tent that seems to be empty. The food is there, all the things and the belongings of the people that obviously put up the tent is there, but they're not there. And it's New Year's Eve. So no crocodiles. I was surprised because it is by a type of lake. And then they go for a hike and they find something. But then we have these flashbacks where we do see the people who obviously occupy the tent. And it's a family of a dad, a stepmom, a new, well, not a newborn baby, but a little toddler, I suppose, and a teenage daughter, always a teenage daughter who's going through something. So there's a little bit of stereotypes in this, like a bloke's made a movie that, you know, look, it always has the teenage girl that's... It's actually a lot like Wolf Creek.
Okay.
The series, I mean.
Oh, the series. Okay, yeah, yeah.
There seems to be a strong element of similarity, or maybe it's just because it is an Australian story that they've set in the country, I don't know. But there's that theme that runs through people from the city trying to get away from something, teenage daughter who's the problem, you know?
Yeah.
And the they seem friendly, but they're not local males, young males. So, yeah, things aren't quite right.
There's that element of putting a woman into this situation, it creates more tension.
I think it's, yeah. It's kind of the trope, I think. You know, paint by numbers sort of horror.
Women need to be saved. Is there any bit of that in there too?
Yeah. There was a bit of that. And there's a few twists, but I won't go into that. So a remote campsite, abandoned tent, romantic getaway to die for. That's the catchphrase. Yes, it's a production. Yeah, world premiere actually. So it's going to have a Q&A. With the director, and Zach Hepburn from the Astor Theatre, and Kayla Janice, she of House of Psychotic Woman. They're going to be introducing the session on the 6th of August with the director, Damien Power. It's had some support from Screen Australia to invest in this, and AFC Indie Vision as well. I'm giving it a 7 out of 10.
Not bad.
It's not the best exploitation, nature fighting back, or crazy country folk fighting back film I've ever seen, but it's got potential. And the only thing I could have thought about, it could have been a bit shorter. It felt like a short film, to be honest, stretched out a bit and starts to get a little bit weak in the plot device. But I did like the forward and back.
Yep, the non-linear.
That did work. Yeah. The non-linear. I did enjoy that. And also there is that creeping feeling that something is really wrong and distasteful. With Aaron Peterson there being, obviously he's Aboriginal, there is a feeling of something terrible's happened to him, but we never find out. There's just that sense that apparently it's on a site that was an Aboriginal massacre. It's called the Weeping Water, the place Gungali, where they camp. So I think there's lots of references for other things that have happened, but they don't go into any great depth. That's okay. It leaves it a bit mysterious.
Yeah.
But gives it that stamp of Australianness. Oi, 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 Aussie, oi, oi.
Let's not go there.
Okay.
I think it's great that they've included an Australian film. And it's
clearly quite low budget too.
Yeah.
But they've done a very good job considering the probably the limitations they have.
I don't necessarily think there's a connection between budget and quality of film.
No, I don't think so. Under the Shadow shows that.
Yeah, too, absolutely.
You know. So, look, Killing Ground, 88 minutes long, so it's not too bad, but it's still a bit too long for me. Thursday the 4th of August, 9 p.m. and Saturday the 6th at 11:30. It's probably one you would not take a date to. Okay.
Unless so you want them to hold you tight.
And then say, let's go for a drive into the countryside, mm-hmm. perhaps not.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Sonia. That was very interesting. And you actually convinced me to see it. So
really?
I
didn't spoil it too much.
No, I'm good. I'm fine for now anyway. Yeah, I'll let you know after I've seen it and said, no, you spoiled it too much. Anyway, you are listening to a podcast of Sci-Fi and Scream Undead. I was going to stop doing that.
No, you were, but you can't help yourself.
I love saying it like that. Already there. Sci-Fi and Scream Undead. So the next one I'm going to talk about is The Devil's Candy, which...
At long last, the return of the precocious and yet very lovable and smart man. I say lovable because I've been lucky to interview him twice now. Oh. And he's just fabulous. Lovely, fabulous guy. Sean Byrne. First film, The Loved Ones, came out in 2009 with Xavier Samuel and... Robin McLeavy, fabulous, just fabulous. Princess in a Dress and a Prom Night That Goes Wrong, we all know that one. That was his first feature and achieved a lot of recognition. Didn't do so well at the box office, sadly, because we still have an issue here in Australia of supporting horror genre, unfortunately. We still don't take it seriously enough. Thank you, Margaret and David. Subtle. But look, he's come a long way, and it's taken 6 years to get this film made and produced.
Wow.
And deliver it. And its premiere, I believe, will be, Australian premiere, yes, is going to be here in Australia, Wednesday the 10th and of August and the 12th of August.
And as he is a director from Hobart, it's great that we're seeing his films down here as well.
Yes. Distinction. Yeah,
absolutely.
Of Hobart.
Yeah, the distinction.
Of Tasmania.
He's the only good person to come out of Hobart. No.
That's a terrible thing. There's two good people.
Okay, yeah.
All right, maybe three. Sean Byrne, what's this about? What is The Devil's Candy to you?
To me. Okay, so our protagonist or antagonist, depending on how you look at it. Yep. He takes sort of both roles. Jesse and his family have just moved into a new home in the country again, sort of.
It's Texas.
Texas, yep. And they slowly start to realize that there's somebody else who wants to be there too.
Yes.
And so someone who keeps knocking on their door and has a bit of an infatuation with the young daughter.
Yeah. As Pruitt Taylor Vince as Ray, Raymond Smiley. That's kind of... a bit obvious. What's he been in?
He's one of those faces that you just know you've seen.
Because he's got an eye that wanders.
Mm, yeah.
Literally.
And, he's in lots of things, but I can't really tell you one of... it's that sort of actor. He's like a character actor who
usually doesn't have very many lines.
He has a few more in this one.
But
he does a great job. He is dead creepy.
Yeah, he is.
So...
So
Jesse, the main male lead, is played by Ethan Embry, who is known, if you are a fan of the series Grace and Frankie, which I quite like. He plays the drug addicted son in that show, and he does a really great performance, a very, very different character. It took me about half the film to realize it was
who
him.
It was. Well, a description here from, I believe that's from the Guardian recently, was Ethan Embry, formerly every parent's favorite clean-cut 90s teen idol, looks like he's been marinating in tobacco juice and beer for a decade in director Sean Byrne's The Devil's Candy. I think that's a pretty good, description.
Absolutely.
We'll just plagiarize that.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
We have.
We're quoting, not plagiarizing. There's a difference. So the performances are great. The wife is... we probably should call her more than the wife.
Yes.
Astrid. She is just that great sort of more clean cut for part of the film, and then kind of that changes a bit. Jesse sort of transitions throughout the film from being... sort of different people, but the big theme throughout this film is that metal theme, which we've seen before in other horror films like Deathgasm and none of those.
Oh, more recently, yes. He hasn't seen Deathgasm. I spoke to Sean Byrne.
Oh, okay.
And he wants to see it. He's heard about
it.
Death by Dildos, as I call it.
Did you say that to him on the interview?
No, I didn't. Okay. I was too embarrassed to do that. But yes, and we talked about the heavy metal aspect, and he's a big fan. I couldn't get him to shut up. Yeah, okay. He's a big fan. It's in The Loved Ones as well. It's a very significant part of the whole picture there. So metal is really infuses his stories. So far.
Which is one of the film parts I loved about the film is the connection between the father and daughter based on their both love of metal.
And some lovely shots. So great scenes there.
Yeah.
They're in the car and the mother-wife, she's not fussed about it.
No, she's like, can we listen to something else for just a little while?
And, of course, he's a painter, so he's painting butterflies for banks, as he says.
Absolutely.
To try and make money. But
to pay for the house.
Very dark paintings that happen a bit later when they move to the new studios, a shed out the back.
And really beautiful paintings, by the way. They're just
and they're real art that Sean said he found on the internet.
Wow.
And followed up the artist, and it's a breakout for this artist, too, I think.
That's great.
Stephen... Gosh, my writing's terrible. Stephen Kasner, his name is. He's also a Satanist.
Oh, cool.
The artist.
Probably the wrong thing you say, cool. I don't know.
No, leave it in.
Believe what you...
It's a church. Yeah. And like, you know, it's no different from being a Baptist.
Absolutely.
Well, a little bit different, but not really. Same sort of knickknacks.
I like that, actually.
Knickknacks. Actually, the Catholics are more knickknacky. Really. But
I just didn't know what to say after that.
And if you like Metallica, Slayer, Avenged, what is it? Sevenfold Avenged Angel. I love them. You're going to love this. And play it loud. Play it loud. I hope the cinema plays it loud.
Yeah, it's definitely a film you should watch loud.
Loud and big. Mm.
Look, it's not music-wise, I didn't enjoy the music, but I enjoyed the music from the point of view of being part of the film.
Mm.
So I'm not a fan of the genre at all.
You hate death metal.
I really hate death metal. I said
it's not all death metal. It's not all death metal.
And the father is a musician in this film as well. So he's...
Yes, so there's a reference there too with, of course, the psychopathic person that used to live in the house, played by Pruitt. He's got a red Gibson Flying B, very rare sort of guitar. I believe they use it in Metallica, and I'm terrible because I can't think of the name of the artist who plays it. But there is those references all through the film, or Easter eggs, I suppose. People call those Easter eggs now.
Yes, that's it.
Don't they? Something like that. So, yeah.
Easter, as long as it's Satan, is Easter.
And Satan loves death metal.
Yeah.
That was terrible. But if you like Discordant, you like feedback, you like your loud music, painting, art, and you like Sean Byrne, and you're excited like I was to see what he's been up to, this is what he's been up to. It's... The Devil's Candy.
And if you want to see what Ethan Embry is capable of, if you have seen him in other things, he does. I loved his performance in this. So, what are you going to give this out of 10, Tonya?
It's a hard one. Between 7 and 8.
Okay, I'm going to go 7. It wasn't my favourite, but I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to see it on the big screen, and I would hope that it's going to be nice and loud. And I'm going to give it an 8, actually, because it is enjoyable. I don't know, because maybe it's because I'm from a provincial town where AC/DC, back seats of old Fords and Belmonts and Kingswoods was my home.
Yep.
As a teenager.
Nice.
Wear a black jersey on. So whatever it is, we're giving the metal...
The devil symbol, I think.
The horned god approves. And anyway, you get to play with Satan.
You do. Why not? Everybody else was taken. So that is...
The Devil's Candy. It's a sweetie.
I seem to keep forgetting the name of this film for some reason.
It's a sweet film.
It is.
With some grit in there.
It's very sweet.
And some metal.
And we're not going to tell you, but I wonder what the candy is that is the Devil's Candy's title refers to.
Chubba Chups?
Yes, it was Chubba Chups, Sonia.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you know the Chubba Chup logo was actually... originally designed by Salvador Dali?
No, I did not.
There you go.
Okay.
Suck on that.
As a little tidbit.
Suck on
random,
that.
Random bit
you
of knowledge.
Surrealist you.
You are listening to a podcast of Sci-Fi and Scream Undead.
Hi, this is Sean. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on
Sci-Fi and Scream.
Hi, this is Sean. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy FM. Is that...
Yeah, that's cool. Can you say your last name? I'm sorry, Sean.
What is it Joy FM or 92 Joy?
94.9. Joy 94.9. Yeah.
Joy 94.9. Hi, this is Sean Byrne. You're listening to... my brain.
That's all right.
Sci-fi and squeam. This is what happens when you have twins.
Oh, good on you.
All right. Hi, this is Sean Byrne. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on 94.9 Joy FM.
Cool. Thank you. That's great.
Is that right? 94.9?
Yeah. That's it, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Thanks.
No worries.
Oh, your name.
Oh.
Oh, sorry. You know, there's something we forgot.
My name's Xavier Samuel. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Perfect. You've done radio before?
Did I have a radio voice then when I said those things?
That's good. Do it again.
Hi, I'm Xavier Samuel. I mean, maybe I've got to work on my radio voice. I don't know.
I love it. It's great. Thanks so much for talking to us on Sci-Fi and Scream.
Thank you. Cheers.
You are listening to a podcast of Sci-Fi and Scream Undead, Joy's new format for exploring the geek queer world. And we are talking myth films, myself, Clayton Claytox Wimshurst, no box involved, and Sci-Fi and Scream's lovely Sonia Hammer.
Lovely.
Also known as Sonia the Screamer.
Sonia the Psycho.
Yeah, and Sonia the Serial Killer, apparently, we found out tonight, too.
Well, you know, just, you know, trying to be accurate when it comes to impact blow of instruments on people's bodies.
I am, yes.
And embalming. Now, this is a bit more serious. This is definitely more serious.
Yeah, we definitely take this one seriously.
Docudrama. And it's called Belief, the Possession of Janet Moses. Directed by and produced by a chap called David Stubbs. I spoke to him, of course. It's screening very soon, actually, 30th of July and the 1st of August at MIFF, Melbourne International Film Fest. How do you, it's the exorcism film, isn't it?
It's a real exorcism film. It's a complex film. It's based on the court case that happened after these events. So it's based on the real testimonials that happened through the court trial. And everything in this film affects people in the real life. There is no... it's not a narrative. It is... It's told in the nature of a narrative with a documentary wraparound. But you need to be aware that when you're watching this film, all of this actually happened.
Yep. That's the thing. It did. And David Stubbs... it's set in a township, I guess you call them townships still in New Zealand, the North Island, Wainuiomata. And, I've been there, used to drive through there, I think, on the way to, I can't remember if it was Auckland or Wellington, but driving through, it's very provincial, New Zealand. There's a creek or a river that runs, a small river, creek, stream. Actually, stream is the right word, that runs through it, which is quite significant later on when we talk about water. And this is based on a true life, a real experience. Because in 2007, Janet Moses' family formed a circle around her, held a vigil for 4 days and nights, pouring water into her eyes and down her throat in a traditional method for expelling a Māori curse. Far from being malicious, their actions led to her death. And it was motivated by... concept of a spiritual belief. So filmmaker David Stubbs, he's been very sensitive in recalling and explaining and retelling and reenacting these scenes, because it's all reenactment as well.
It is, and it's done very much without blame throughout a lot of it. He's done what a documentary should do, which is present in quite an impassionate view of these events. Mm. I formed an opinion on it, which... is a complex thing, but he doesn't make you form an opinion, but you probably will.
Yes, I think that it's a tricky one because it's based on something called Makatu, and Makatu is considered to be the devil's work or a type of sorcery, witchcraft, Māori traditional witchcraft. Spirituality would also come into there, and I think it's morphed over a period of time due to the impact of Christianity and missionary, you know, and colonialism.
And I think that actually is one of the biggest points about this film, is that these events, if this had been taken from a purely traditional culture point of view, then I don't think these things would have happened. It's actually the influence of that colonialism and that religion that's coming into it and being mixed up and messed up.
Yeah, very messed up. I mean, from our perspective, very messed up. I guess if you're not in the inferno that it became or the eye of the storm, it's something that is more tangible and real. They also point out, the director also points out through the film, that at every stage that this was happening, the family were becoming more close and closed in and close-knit, because they're already close-knit. It's a small Māori community, or hapu. The iwi is that they are very closely knitted and tied. Everybody is, cousin to cousin to cousin and related. And because of that, I guess you could say it becomes this this paradigm of if something's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong and affect everyone. It's going to be big and it's going to have huge ripple effects, which again plays on.
And it does.
The concept that they have is that water, I don't know if you remember in the film, they mentioned the element of water is very important in their family, something to do with water. Lions, their family name, the Moses, I think, because it's the family name.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Has to do with a lion. All these sort of symbolic things, and these people take these things literally. They take it literally, and we can judge and we can say, oh, look, is it because they're not educated in a certain way? Or we could say that as outsiders, or we could just go watch the movie, try to understand it, let it happen. And you do, you're sort of like an observer watching something that is starting to spiral out of control and the real sense of it.
I think we can safely say the people in this film did the wrong thing. But what we also can say is they did the wrong thing from their point of view for the right reasons.
David points out in the interview we had with him, David Stubbs, which you'll get to hear, he actually says it's a love story. Mm. He calls it a love story, a tragic love story, a love story of a community for a woman who's part of their community, a sister, an aunt, a cousin, a daughter, that they wanted to help. She's clearly snapped. There's been a psychosis.
She's had a psychotic break. Psychotic break.
Yeah, so psychotic break of some sort, according to Dr. Tapsell, who's in the film, and he has a Māori background as well. He's a psychiatrist. And he says, from what his analysis is, that she's had some sort of trauma. A couple of bad things have happened to her. The grandmother, who she was very close to, Kuia, Māori grandmother, has passed away, and her partner has had an infidelity of some sort and has no longer on the scene, basically.
Absolutely.
Left her. So she's left with two daughters to raise. Not on her own, obviously, but, you know, it's a big commitment to raise any child, particularly when your partner's left you and your grandmother's not there, who she was close to, as I mentioned.
Yeah, you stick those events together, that will bang, at least temporarily break someone. So,
and so the family aren't aware of, I guess, any alternative options. They then go to a tohunga, who is like a, some would say a witch doctor, but it's probably best to say a type of minister, spiritual person of faith that you go to.
You definitely don't get any witch doctor feel from that. I'm going to say character at this stage because of the nature of the film, but yeah.
And they go to him and he sees her and recognizes that she has something called makatū, and that therefore, there are certain protocols and things they can do to try to make her well and take that bad spirit or bad energy from her.
And he,
however, he then isn't part of the scene, and they think that was
because he has to go for surgery. So
so he's not around for any more advice and to be there to support them on what they decide to do. The family. So that's when everything starts to go to shit.
Absolutely. And he sees this. The family have stolen this lion. From a pub. And
it's not a real lion. A stone lion.
No, it's a stone lion. Sorry, that's quite an important point.
People going, wow, they've got lions over there?
So they've stolen this lion, and he sees it at the traditional priest. I don't know how to word that better.
Tohunga.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And he sees that it's because they've separated these two spirits from in these lions that they are taking their revenge on Janet.
Yeah.
So, and Janet being the weakest link in the family because of her emotional state.
Yeah, yeah. So she's, she probably just needed some time. We would say she probably needed some time. She probably needed some therapeutic advice or even medicine, Western medicine. But, hey, yeah. What are we to say?
A prominent point. On the other hand, in the film is that these two lions, these stone lions, were quite new and also aged with yogurt. So to give that sort of aged impression. So it's...
But you're wrapped up in it, aren't you?
Absolutely.
I was totally engaged. It was just not just the way the story does pan out because it's a true thing, but the cinematography was amazing.
It's very beautiful.
The look of the film.
I'm not usually, like, I watch horror films all the time. They don't bother me. This was one of the most disturbing films.
Because it's true.
I've seen, because it's so true. And it you feel what's happening. It's not just a true story. You feel like it's happening in front of you, which it is. But, you know, you're actually there.
Mm. It's a remarkable docudrama, documentary slash drama. It's, I've never seen anything like it.
One thing
to
I was
quite honest.
This
maybe
is
close to Emily Rose, the possession.
I haven't
of
seen
Emily
that one,
Rose,
but I'm going to check that out now. Mm. This we're going to be a little bit spoilery through this one, and what I want to say is what I was impressed by was the way the courts actually handled this. It wasn't, and it shows how New Zealand is so much ahead of Australia in a lot of ways, and this is definitely one of them. The courts handled it very much with respect, and I think the sentence that was given was very tempered. And was responsive to their cultural needs. So
they were suffering terribly. There is real live footage in the film later on. You do see the real people, what they look like and at the time. So you get a sense of that, and you can also look it up online to find out more about the case. But, yes, it was handled with definite cultural sensitivity. I must admit I do miss that. Part of not being an Aotearoa is I miss that integration and real biculturalism that does happen there. Whether you agree with biculturalism or not doesn't matter, but in this case it's digested well into the community, and I think it's a terrible sentence, but it's a terrible thing that happened, awful thing that happened, but you know that they've been punished, you know that they've lost something integral, which was a human life.
They've been punished well
before
the trial,
and you know that it can't happen again.
Absolutely. You know? Another, with your biculturalism, which I just, it's really not important to the film, but I really loved the New Zealand justice symbol, which had one side had a traditional Māori person and on the other
warrior
side had... So that I thought that was really great that they're representing all parts of that culture.
That's always been there, though. It's like...
I hadn't seen it before. I'm
Māori
not
chief.
From New Zealand.
I don't know who the Māori chief is. I should look it up. But there's the Māori chief with his cloak and spear and taihara, I think it is. And there's the female symbol of justice or liberty.
Yeah, so I think it's a great cultural balance, which I think we're so far from in Australia. We shouldn't be.
We can't take it for granted, that's for sure. But an argument to that would be, this happened because of biculturalism.
Oh, absolutely.
Well. There's the opposite argument.
Which
that,
I said earlier about the whole... it was the integration of the two religions that caused the issue.
Yeah, you're right. So they do get some little news headlines of what was happening to give a really strong idea or sense of what was going on in the news at the time. Because it is shocking that someone could drown on land and be drowned basically by the people that love her.
And they show footage from real news footage from Australia. I think there's a couple of Australian ones in there as well. Because I actually definitely remember this when it first happened. I remember
the name, Janet Moses. Yeah. I remember the name.
Well, I remember them talking about the case because I was interested in the whole, because of the possession sort of concept to it and that sort of thing. So that definitely interested me because of my horror sort of love. Those sort of things interest me. And, and now seeing this film, I understand much better.
Yeah, this is not The Conjuring or The Exorcist. This is the real thing and what happens when you go too far. So, I'm really impressed. David Stubbs was wonderful to speak to, certainly very sensitive. He's from Wainuiomata, so it was a stomping ground as well. Wonderful performances. It must have been incredibly difficult to do those roles, particularly if you were a Māori actor, and I presume they all would have been Māori actors or are Māori actors. Amazing that they could do this. That could not have been easy because culturally that would be difficult, very difficult, and possibly even a bit dangerous, to be quite honest.
I can understand
that. I'm not superstitious.
Mm.
I'm probably more agnostic in many ways, but something happened while we were on the phone, actually. I was interviewing him.
Ah, yes.
I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. More about phone. I don't know.
The phones went a little wrong.
They went a little wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We've got wonderful Kura Forrester as Janet Moses, a breakaway performance. I don't think she speaks much in it at all, actually. She's mainly possessed.
But she gets so much across without speaking.
Exactly. And another standout was Hariata Moriarty, was the teenage girl. So that was a very clever way that they put her in the story too.
And her story within it is
frightening,
and in its own ways equally horrific as Janet's.
Yeah, because it was really escalating in the house. The house where this so-called exorcism was performed was, they were without food. I mean, they hadn't eaten. They hadn't slept for 3 days or something.
They hadn't. Didn't it have was 40 degrees. 40 degree days. No inside. Access to toilets. People were using nappies and things like that. So it's... Yeah,
a recipe for disaster. Yeah, exactly.
And disaster is what happened.
Beautiful cinematography, Matthew Knight, Thomas Robbins is producer, Rian Sheehan, composer, great music there too. And David Stubbs is the writer, director and producer as well. So yes, I don't do this very often, but I'm giving this a 9 out of 10.
I was also going to give it a 9, and of the films we've seen, this is my pick.
This is your pick so far?
Okay. Definitely.
So that is Belief, The Possession of Janet Moses. It's very limited play time here, screening at MIFF, but it's Saturday the 30th of July and Monday the 1st of August, and you can check that out by going to miff.org.com.
And I actually might be sending a little email to Nova to say, yeah, I think you need to pick up this film, because I think it's that good. I think it needs to be seen by everybody.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's a heavy one.
Mm.
Like, we've really, our tone has changed completely.
Mm. We were quite jovial through the others, but this one is a very powerful and important film. So thank you very much
for
joining us.
Part one.
That is for part one. We do have part two, which will be coming up in the next week.
Yeah, what's in that one?
So in part two, we're going to be looking at other films, the Lure. Which I haven't seen yet, but I'm looking forward to that one.
Baskin.
Great title.
Consider the bloodiest of bloody films from Turkey.
Mm-hmm. I've only seen, not the trailer, just a little bit of the images.
That's
and
just
it's,
enough,
it's,
isn't it? How much blood is on that person? Mm-hmm. Emo the Musical.
Which I've heard good things about.
And The Neon Demon. And, of course, which is one I've been hanging out for, Nicholas Raffin Wenden, I always get his name wrong, the Danish director of Drive, finally. This looks like the one. And for him, and High Rise.
Which,
by Ben Wheatley.
It's my dystopian futures genre, which is my favourite. So.
Yeah, it's set in the 70s, isn't it? J.G. Ballard?
Book? Is it set in the 70s? I actually didn't know that part. So, okay, it's a dystopian alternate reality thing, which I love too. So.
No, but it's set in the 70s because it's written in the 70s.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so I think it's just set in the time it's set in. But it is a Wheatley film, so if you love Kill List, what's the name of the holiday makers? No, what was it called? Sightseers, the Wheatleys, which includes Amanda Jump. This is a big one for Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
Who's in it?
And it's good to see him in something a bit more alternative as well, rather than the big blockbusters. So,
I know, but I think they're counting on this one to do very well, I
absolutely,
think,
yeah.
When it comes to semi-independent cinema, I guess.
Absolutely.
Semi, as Americans would say. It's a semi-truck you're pulling.
Okay, so
that's it.
We are Sci-Fi and Scream Undead. We will be around still. We're not yet living and we're not dead. Mm. If you want to check us out, you can head to joy.org.au/sci-fi-and-scream. The address is not changing. You can still find us at the same place. The logo will be changing soon, though.
Mm.
If you have an idea for something you'd like Sonia and I to have a chat about, you can send through a message. sci-fi-and-scream@joy.org.au. Thank you so much for listening, and we will scare you soon.
Thank you, and good night.
Oh, I can still see it. Beautiful girl. Absolutely beautiful, Mum. Just what happened to her is so sad.
Te kohurutanga o Janet Moses.
Janet Moses died during a mark
killing a young mum during an exorcism ceremony.
This has been a very controversial case.
Don't judge a book by its cover.
They genuinely believed there was something malignant within her.
Was in danger. You don't do those things. You don't muck around with mouldy things.
You can't just act on bizarre beliefs and kill someone and nothing's done about it.
Over the last 200 years, there's been a process of colonization. It's important to hold fast to the traditional Maori beliefs.
But if you don't know the language and the protocol and you do it the wrong way, well, that's what happens.
Get out! Get out of here!
You cannot have her!
We're a close family and we always get together to solve our problems.
Go with peace and love.
Stuck in a room for 5 days with no sleep. Chanting, stomping.
Hysteria is a not uncommon state.
No, 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 no!
It's a life and death thing, isn't it?
We love you, girl!
You can just imagine the pressure, the fear, the panic. Comes down to your love for that person.
Go with peace and love!
Come on, Bruno!
To stay there and to endure it.
You know, we just love our family so much, you know.
The trial of 9 people charged with the manslaughter of a relative during an exorcism has taken a dramatic twist.
Thanks for listening to Sci-Fi and Scream Undead,
a podcast of Joy 94.9. You can find more at joy.org.au/sci-fi-and-scream.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.